And once the Versailles Treaty was signed, those dominoes kept falling. And President Wilson seemed to think that with his moral rhetoric that he could change world history and change humanity. But his moral arrogance was just incredibly damaging. And it was also very damaging to the Democratic Party. It's interesting that the U.S. had basically won the war by the time the November 1918 congressional elections were held. But Wilson's party, the Democrats, still got clobbered. And in 1920, Wilson was not running for re-election, but there was the Democrats got clobbered then again, partly because of the odiousness of what the war had come to stand for from Americans' point of view.
Yeah, another similarity with Iraq, right? Everybody, I guess I wasn't there. I went around for the beginning of Vietnam. But boy, I remember a lot of denial of the real world we're living in the run-up to Iraq, about how sweet and swell and quick and easy this is going to be.
Perhaps you know, can answer this off the top of your head, how many combat veterans were saying that? I mean, it's my guess that there was a much lower percentage of combat veterans were saying that than pundits and intellectuals and columnists and TV talking heads, the same kind of TV talking heads who are wetting their pants over the missile strike in Syria last week.
Yeah. Well, and I dare say virtually every regular Joe on the bottom half of economic society in America didn't support the war. That doesn't necessarily mean the left half either. But, you know, because there were a lot of people who are a lot more, say, country than rock and roll, for example, who never believed in little country club cheerleader Yale boy George W. Bush. You know, he never represented them. They never believed for a minute that he cared about them, or that, you know, that his war was for them, to protect them, or anything like that. And I knew all kinds of just regular schmucks who knew way better than to believe in the war in 2002. And yeah, I'm sure that included a lot of veterans as well. You know, I knew part of the reason I knew, well, just one small part of it, though, but I just spent my whole life seeing Vietnam veterans standing on the side of the road begging with signs. And
wow,
that just goes to show right there, well, geez, why aren't they put up in some government boarding house somewhere being taken care of? Man, this guy looks like he's dying, you know, on the side of the road. Nobody cares about him at all, apparently. But then this is that same government. It's just George Bush inheriting that same government a generation later, doing the same thing again. Why would I believe in that? I think a lot of people, without knowing the details of Saddam Hussein and his weapons programs, just didn't trust it, you know, and they were right not to.
Yeah, well, I mean, and there was so much exaggerating. Well, Dick Cheney, the kind of statements he was making were just so bizarre. But the press corps was basically cheering them on. Most of the Washington press corps, the Northeast Corridor press corps. So it was appalling.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I actually heard stories of Texans getting lynched, or at least attempted, almost being lynched. Texans of German heritage, for not being on board the war and not all hailing Wilson and this kind of thing.
That sounds very, very plausible. There was Thomas Fleming book talks about some of the lynchings of Germans here in the U.S. And if memory serves, there was a case in the Missouri which was cheered by the Washington Post.
Wow. Amazing. And this is just for not being on board for the thing, right? This isn't for sabotage at an army base or anything.
Right, right. I mean, to throw in a flip side is, I mean, from, it was clear from 1914, 1915 that the U.S. was aiding the war effort. And there was some German sabotage, even by someone who grew up close to where I lived. I was raised on a mountainside in the Shenandoah Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, I was raised in this. Here we go. Here's our first World War story for you. I was raised on a beef cattle research station, federal state combo, and before that, it was an Army remount center. And it was one of the main centers for sending horses to the First World War. And there were tens of thousands of horses that passed through this place that were sent to the sent to France. I think a lot of them ended up in French restaurants, but that's another story. But it turned out there were some Germans that had settled the area as farmers. There was a family named Dilger And about 2 miles from where I was raised, there was a Dilger barn named after this family, whose land was seized at the time that the U.S. government decided to take this land for to train the U.S. cavalry. But Dilger had a son who went to medical school in Heidelberg, then came back here and was actually trying to help sabotage some of the U.S. horses that were being sent to France. I think he was using anthrax or something like that. So there was actually a book about that about 8 or 10 years ago. So, and I had no idea that I was raised close by where someone who was a World War I saboteur was raised. So
it's a small world.
Amazing. I didn't have space for that in the USA Today piece, but what the hell, I'll throw it out here now.
Yeah, that's a good one.
You know, it needs to be a little fresh in my mind to tell a good story, but yeah, that's the gist.
Hey, one more thing, the flu. What's the flu got to do with the war, Jim? Tell him.
Well, the Spanish flu, according to some reports, it was first came out of a army camp in Kansas. Totally swept under the rug is that there were all kinds of scandals about the horrible conditions at the U.S. training camps that caused a lot of unnecessary deaths of American conscripts. And among some of those unsanitary conditions, the Spanish flu came out. It may have also come out other places. It's unclear where it first originated. But 500,000 Americans died from the Spanish flu that was spurred and spread by the war, something which happened when the Spanish flu outbreak started to happen. There was in some places there was censorship, so people did not learn there was an epidemic. Because the government thought it would be bad for the morale or who knows what. And that's something which probably increased the death toll. So,
amazing. All right, wait, one more thing again. The alcohol, the ban of beer sales. Not wine, but just beer. Is that that's an anti-German measure, or they're just raising taxes?
Yes, I mean, here again, folks, a lot of people say, well, prohibition, it was too bad, da-da-da-da, but it was sold in part as an anti-German measure. And many of the breweries, maybe most of them back then, were owned by German Americans. Quality of American beer was a hell of a lot better then than it was for the subsequent 50 years after Prohibition ended. So the First World War not only did it have the carnage in Europe, but it resulted in the triumph of the equivalent of the Taliban here at home. If it had not been for the war, Prohibition almost certainly would not have been enacted nationwide. The 18th Amendment would very likely not have passed. The 18th Amendment banned alcohol consumption. But even before the 18th Amendment passed, President Wilson banned beer sales. And so, I mean, what's the point of living if you can't have beer?
That's a really good question for beer drinkers. I know beer is really important to you people.
Well, yeah, you know, I'm still hoping it's going to cause my hair to grow back. It hasn't worked yet, but I'm still drinking.
I should try that. Hey, listen, and the poisoning thing, it sounds like a lie. You must be lying about the poisoning of the alcohol, Jim.
I had a professor decide for that source. Yeah, this is something that's probably started after Wilson. I'm not sure when during Prohibition the poisoning started, but what was happening is that there was industrial alcohol that was the people would sometimes try to convert to drinkable hooch. And so the thing the Fed started doing is adding poison to industrial alcohol, and there were 10,000 people who were killed as a result of the federal poisoning.
Oh, but that was under the Republicans? That figures too, I guess.
There was a very good book on this by Deborah Bloom. The book's title is The Poisoner's Handbook.
Wow. Yeah. About Uncle Sam, chief poisoner.
That's actually a much lower cost than the war on drugs, but that's a different story.
Yeah. Well, it goes to show the lengths they'll go anyway. Yeah. I saw a thing this morning. Did you see they arrested a guy on a 30-year-old cocaine businessman warrant from the days of Miami Vice down there. He'd been living in Orlando. They couldn't catch him living 20 miles away, 100 miles away for 30 years. But they bravely, you know, they announced their awesome victory this morning. Well, we caught him, everybody. He was out riding bikes with his wife.
Well, I've never trusted bike riders.
Yeah, well, they're dangerous people, apparently. Yeah, cocaine businessmen, too. All right, hey, listen, I've wasted enough of your time today, Jim. Thank you for coming on my show. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much, Scott, and thanks for the chance to brush some of the rust off my mind. And best of luck to you and the Libertarian Institute. I'm really glad you guys are out there and y'all are doing great work.
Well, thanks very much, Jim. I appreciate it.
Okay.
All right, you guys, that is the great Jim Bovard. JimBovard.com, that's his website where he keeps all his stuff, including all his great articles that he's written for the Wall Street Journal and USA Today and all kinds of other great places over the years. I mean, and when I say years, I mean going back to the 80s and 90s. I don't know. His archive on the site goes at least back to the 90s. A lot of great Waco stuff there and all kinds of stuff. And then he wrote The Farm Fiasco, The Fair Trade Fraud, Feeling Your Pain, Freedom in Chains, Terrorism and Tyranny, The Bush Betrayal, Attention Deficit Democracy, and the latest is his great memoir. It's called Public Policy Hooligan. And you can read in there why the directors of virtually every national government department that's ever been created have specifically denounced Jim by name for his great journalism about their lousy work and dangerous work. The great Jim Bovard, everybody, Public Policy Hooligan. I'm Scott Horton. Check out the archives at scotthorton.org and at libertarianinstitute.org. Follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Thanks. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show.
I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1-ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commoditydiscs. Commodity discs.